I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at Surrey Farms. .com or virginiatraditions.com.
Good morning. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your show's host, Katie Kiefer. My partner in crime, Patrick, is on the road today, but he'll be back next week. We have a really special show, so do stay tuned. We'll be talking about bonsai, about Japanese food, and about the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens in just a moment with Anita Jacobs, who is the director of programming at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, Philip Gilmore, who is the proprietor and chef for the Momo Sushi Shack in Brooklyn, and Julian Velasco, who is our bonsai master and the curator of the bonsai exhibition at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. So we'll be right back in just a second. And stay tuned, because it's going to be a great show. This is The Main Course. So we're in the studio with Julian Velasco. And Julian, let's start off with you, because you will be, you are the curator and the chief bonsai master at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens. And there's a very, very important and wonderful exhibition coming up at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, which is called, Julian, help me out, Graceful Perseverance. Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a great pleasure
great to
have
here.
You. Yeah, absolutely. So Julian, tell us a little bit about what the exhibition is going to be and the
sure.
collection at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, which is one of the most important in the world, right?
Yes, it's one of the oldest in the United States. It started in 1935, and we have close to 400 bonsais in the collection. And we're doing a show called Graceful Perseverance, and it's running until May 1st.
And it opened, right, February 2nd, but you have a kickoff event February 11th, which is a week, which is Friday, this coming
yes,
Friday.
Yes, this
right?
coming Friday, yep.
So, and tickets are available on brown paper tickets for that, right, Anita?
Yeah, you just go on the Brooklyn Botanic Garden website, bbg.org.
Fantastic.
And so, we also have tickets at Momo Sushi Shack.
Oh, yay. Okay, great. And Momo's, well, we'll get to where Momo Sushi Shack is and what you're going to be serving. But Julian, let's start off with, first of all, what got you into bonsai, since you're not Japanese?
No, I'm not. Well, I started when I was younger, I wanted to be a photographer. Mm-hmm. So I was really interested in nature photography and landscape photography. And I would go and hike and camp in a lot of the national forests and really try to immerse myself in that environment. When I was photographing, I would try to capture not only the scenery or the scene, I wanted to capture the essence and the mood of the environment, which is, at least for me, it wasn't exactly easy to do. So when I first saw a bonsai in a street fair, I really was drawn to it just as an oddity or just something very cute just to have in the apartment. And the bonsai started to get weak because I didn't know how to take care of plants in general. And so what I did was I went to a bonsai shop, and once I saw the trees there, it really piqued my curiosity. And that owner showed me a couple of books, bonsai books, that really I instantly fell in love with just the beauty of the trees. And those same trees, no matter how oddly they were shaped or how contorted the trees were, they were the trees that I was used to seeing in the mountains, in the rugged environments. So I was really
Like, what kind of trees are we talking about here? Pine trees?
Well, with bonsai, it could be pine trees or deciduous trees. Any tree could be converted into bonsai.
And the trick to bonsai is you've changed the root structure so that it grows with a sort of a spongy root group instead of one long taproot,
A lot.
And what does that do? Explain how that changes the way the tree understands itself and its environment.
Sure. A lot of people think bonsai is sort of restricting the growth or really manipulating the tree's growth to keep it small. But really, we're trying to promote extremely vigorous growth. So what we do is we develop a very fibrous root system. Trees in nature, they use roots to anchor themselves down and to push through the ground. And at the ends of all those roots, these thicker roots, we have small, fine feeder roots. And those feeder roots are the ones that take up all the nutrients and water up to the plant. And with bonsai, we want to promote just those small feeder roots through very specific bonsai techniques. And then once the tree develops these very dense, fibrous hair roots, the tree or the bonsai believes that the root system is much larger than it really is. And because plants in general, they use, it's basically instinct, the way they grow. If the tree believes that the root system is much larger than it is, that means it feels stable and mature in its environment. And those roots are directly related to the canopy on top. So when you have a very dense root system, you're going to have a very dense canopy. And the combination of the dense canopy and the very dense root system creates a balance. And once that tree has that balance and achieves that equilibrium in energy from the roots and the foliage, the tree truly believes that it's 20, 30 feet tall.
I love that idea.
Yeah, yeah. So once it's mature, the growth habit changes, and that's the amazing thing about bonsai. It's not a tree pruned to look like a larger tree. It actually transforms into a full-grown tree, whether it's 3 inches tall or 20 inches tall.
One of the sort of article that Anita sent me to prepare for this program, there's a quote here that I really liked a lot. And I think this comes from you, right, Julian?
Perhaps.
Every tree has a hidden inner story, a novel's worth of imagery and narrative. And the gift of the bonsai master is to be able to read that story, even if the tree is in a raw and unstyled state. One must resist the temptation to impose one's own will on the tree and instead draw inspiration from the tree itself, and in this way begin to form a connection. So there's a very spiritual aspect to bonsai that I'd love to have you expand on a little bit.
That's one of the many great things about bonsai is there's so many levels of enjoyment, horticulture, and this sort of philosophical, spiritual aspect. And the wonderful thing about art in general, or even cooking, it really is the viewers or the participants' a connection with what you're trying to present. So in my case, it's bonsai, or in the chef's case, it's preparing food, and it's the guests or the viewers' participation that really makes the experience grow and expand. So with bonsai specifically, it's my job to sort of try to bring out the essence or the soul of the tree, so that the tree itself has the best opportunity and the most tools so that it can express emotions and feelings and an environment. So with bonsai, because we're dealing with nature and trying to not necessarily replicate what nature looks like visually, we want to replicate what nature feels like, what that environment makes us feel inside, and try to pinpoint the essence and the spirituality of nature. So with bonsai, it's really amazing. When I was photographing and hiking in the mountains and camping, you know, a lot of times I would be out there for, you know, 10, 15 days at a time, really just, you know, just getting a feel for the environment and really letting it absorb into me. And with bonsai, if you're able to communicate and let the bonsai communicate with you, and this kind of communication is obviously not with words, it's with imagery, emotions, and aura, and basically it sort of it draws you in and creates the opportunity to be able to sort of transport yourself in that sort of environment. And a lot of the beauty of nature in these wonderful environments is not necessarily just what you're seeing with your eyes. It's your other senses, and also your inner spiritual sort of senses. So by letting the bonsai sort of lead you into this environment, it's really similar and actually to me at least, it's exactly the same as being in those environments. So if you're in the middle of a city and you have a well-designed bonsai, and you kind of relax your mind, and you, you know, let your guard down, and let the bonsai communicate, and you use your own life experience and your life story to help the bonsai expand on that, on its story. So each viewer has a different a view of the natural environment that the tree is trying to portray, and it's the combination of the bonsai with 50% of the viewer trying to create the feelings and emotions of being in that environment.
I'm wondering, how did bonsai get started? Like, who figured this out? It's a very old art form.
Sure is, yeah. It's, you know, basically, it started in China. And what happens in nature, especially in a mountainous area, a seed might fall into a rock crevice.
Uh-huh.
And so the roots obviously don't have much room to grow. And also in the mountains, it snows early, and the snow melts later in the season. So the growing season is very short. And you also have this trapped root system. So the trees, a lot of the trees will naturally get dwarfed and stunted. So you can have a tree that's 300 years old or 500 years old, or even older, and it could be 2 feet tall or 3 feet tall, just because of that environment. So what the Chinese did was they would collect those trees and bring it into their gardens, and little by little they figured, all right, if I prune a little bit here, prune a little bit there, it'll really look like that tree I saw, you know, the larger tree I saw in the mountains, and little by little. You know, they started putting it in pots, and it sort of developed like that. It, you know, we're talking an art form that's well over 1,000 years old.
Wow.
And coincidentally, because of, you know, the tree's psychology, where, you know, a few hundred years ago, they would dwarf their bonsais by letting it get root-bound or really fertilizing it or not fertilizing it at all, and so the tree would get dwarfed. But luckily, what happens is with modern bonsai techniques, you are developing such a vigorous, fibrous root system that you don't. We don't need to let the root system get pot bound. So there's no constriction of growth. All we do is we multiply the density of the root system. So that it's very similar to. To that small captured root system, but it's just much more healthy and vigorous. So now we get the same results of dwarfing the tree, but keeping the tree healthy and vigorous. And a bonsai should live 2 to 3 times, if taken care of properly, I should say, 2 to 3 times longer than its counterpart in nature. Because we're always refreshing and revitalizing the root system. And by pruning the tree, it's not necessarily pruning to keep it small. We want to prune it so that sunlight can filter in into the branches, and we're constantly rejuvenating the branches and the foliage. So every time there's a rejuvenation, the tree builds strength and keeps its youth. So if a tree in nature has a 200-year or 300-year lifespan, theoretically, if taken care of properly, a bonsai should live three times that age, which is pretty amazing.
How old is the oldest bonsai you have in the collection at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens?
We have trees that are over 300 years old, and many that are well over 100 years old, and it's pretty amazing and a great opportunity to be able to just be a part of that tree's history or the bonsai's history, because you know, people had to water and take care of and fertilize and check for insects and love the tree every day for whatever 100 years, 200 yes. years, and so really is just an honor to be able to
yeah,
to work
people
with
come
trees.
And go, but the tree remains. Love that idea. Yeah, I think that's really cool. So, Julian, let's talk a little bit. Let's get Phil in on the conversation, since Phil is knowledgeable about Japanese cuisine. And I wanted to just touch on sort of the connection between the Japanese aesthetic of kind of manipulating things that are already in nature and even very beautiful in nature, but somehow making them even more sort of precious and perfect. And that is very true in Japanese food, Phil, don't you think?
One thing that he said that kind of sparked something in my mind when you were saying, like, sometimes they would over-fertilize or sometimes not fertilize at all to manipulate the tree. I think the same is true with food. Sometimes you taste something that you're making and you want to over-salt it, or sometimes you want to add zero salt to manipulate the food to kind of showcase its own natural flavor.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, actually. Yeah. And then also there's the whole thing in Japanese cuisine of creating these little pictures on the plate and cutting out little pieces of this or that and putting them together in another way that creates a completely different experience but is still drawing on the natural beauty of each one of those components.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a real similarity with bonsai where you have the beautiful thing already, the tree. I mean, we all love trees. We love our trees. Yeah. But to bring them down and to move them into ways that is very much of a human expression of what beauty and aesthetics should be, and yet still retaining that natural quality, like really presenting that in a way that makes it sort of new and different and makes you look at it, I think, more carefully, right?
Yeah.
I saw some photographs of some of the things, some of the tapas you're going to be creating. I can't even remember where I saw that now. But you have these amazing little objects that you'll be serving. And I really, really little works, little individual miniature works of art in and of themselves.
Sure.
So where did your aesthetic sense come from that was what you were drawn to?
Well, I'm not going to say that the concept of the restaurant is everything small, because
we have
giant plates and stuff. But one dish that we do at the restaurant that I think kind of rings true is we have something called the Hotote Punch, which is basically it's a scallop, just one scallop. And, you know, a lot of times when you eat scallop, you get the whole scallop and you might eat the whole thing or you might cut it in half. With this specific dish, we actually mince it up. It's a scallop from Hokkaido, and we chop it into probably about 70 or 80 little pieces, and we just mix in a little bit of pickled wasabi stem inside that, and then just a couple drops of tamari, and that's it. And so you're eating one tiny little piece of scallop, but it's literally, you forget the beauty of what the scallop is, because we're so used to just eating big bites of it, and you take this little tiny bite of scallop and a little piece of pickled wasabi stem, and it's literally like you're eating a mouthful of full food, even though it's this little tiny guy, you know?
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's very similar with bonsai. With bonsai, it seems like we're manipulating and trying to manipulate how the tree grows, but really it's trying to cut away or eliminate everything that's really unnecessary to express the environment or the emotion that you're trying to help the tree express. So by keeping it and simplifying the scene that you're trying to create, it forces the viewer to really use their own imagination and their own emotions to create something that's as large as a whole environment. And that's basically kind of similar to what you were saying.
Yeah.
Well, one of the other things that really struck me when I was reading through this material was that you said that the successful bonsai is designed so that visitors not only see the tree form or architecture, but to go back to this idea of the environment. And I know that bonsai often are, sometimes they're built on a little rock.
Sure.
You know, they'll, like, even in their little tiny pot, mm-hmm. they're going to say something about the surrounding landscape from which they would originally have come.
Yes.
And you try to recreate that.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, like, the different landscapes that you create,
sure,
depending
sure.
on the different trees.
Yeah, there's, you know, thousands of different ways a tree might grow in nature. And we have to, as bonsai artists, we use that knowledge to try to have as many options as we can when we design a tree, because we have to bring out, like I said before, the essence of the tree that we're working with. So by having a great idea of how the different shapes and forms a tree might grow, it really helps us with the design process. And like I mentioned, since the root system is so efficient and very dense, it doesn't matter if the pot is 1 inch deep or shallow, I should say, or if the root system is growing over a rock. Because the root system is so efficient, it doesn't need a large pot comparatively for the size of the tree. And actually, if it was growing in a larger pot, the root system would not grow the correct way to make the bonsai believe that it's full grown. So we have at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, we have trees that are growing over rock, and you'll see sometimes the exposed root as the years go on, the roots kind of turn into bark, and they get woody, and we have trees that sort of cascade, so it sort of looks like a tree is kind of cascading off a cliff or something. So we're always trying to create trees that that kind of replicate all sorts of different environments. It doesn't have to be mountainous trees or very extreme trees. It could be, very lush and big and round trees that you might see in a field or in a prairie kind of area.
I was going to ask you if you could tell me about, there's a couple bonsai that he takes care of, one specifically that's kind of growing sideways, but it mm-hmm. has an inter, like, it looked like somebody was trying to take two trees and wrap them around each other,
yeah.
and then one of them died. So it's this beautiful deadwood, mm-hmm. like bleached white deadwood around a live bonsai, and it's such a beautiful metaphor almost for life and death.
But those are actually quite beautiful. Actually, what looks like it's two trees and one died is really just one tree. And basically, the tree you're talking about, that's a juniper bonsai, and junipers in nature, they live for thousands of years, and what happens is they're usually growing in very harsh environments. So for them to be able to live for so many years, they need to be able to adapt relatively quickly to their environment. And this environment, it might snow a lot, or lightning happens quite often, or just hard winds, or rocks might fall from the surrounding mountainous areas. So let's say a heavy snow fell that year, and it'll break a particular branch of that tree. Well, the lifeline and the root system that brings the nutrients up to that branch, that whole section will die off slowly, and the environment itself will kind of bleach that wood sort of a whitish gray, which is what you saw.
Wow.
And then as the tree, but obviously it won't kill the tree; it'll just kill that one branch, and that's natural for that species. And then as the tree grows and gets older, it'll still expand and grow. And then within the lifeline, it'll just keep on happening. So you'll have a wonderful sort of a calligraphy type look, and very twisty and look of live wood combined with dead wood. So that bonsai was sort of a replica of that sort of idea of these trees that, they're in such harsh environments that they need to be able to adapt quickly. So that bonsai had a lot of dead wood and live wood, and all that was created by the bonsai artist, but still always keeping a respect for the plant. So, creating dead wood with live wood, it doesn't necessarily hurt the plant because that's its natural characteristics to do that. So it doesn't affect its health or its growth, and it just adds to a very sort of sculptural look. And that particular bonsai, I believe it was growing over a rock, so that just adds to the scene, you know, just really brings the whole scene together.
Good. And I was just thinking, your title is curator, but you really are curating from a collection of 400 bonsai for this Graceful Perseverance show.
Yes.
And so a lot of the pieces are very selected to mm-hmm. reflect rugged and harsh yep. environments. Mm-hmm. And do you want to talk about, you're going to be revolving
sure, sure.
the pieces
yeah,
throughout
yeah.
the museum throughout the next few months.
Yeah, you're right. This is something that I've been working on for a while now. With bonsai, like I mentioned, it's sort of the connection with the environment. So usually a viewer, it's just one viewer or a couple of viewers with one bonsai. And that one bonsai is trying to show you the imagery and the emotions or whatever. And with the normal collection we have, I need to show various different styles and shapes and different varieties of plants as you know during the typical exhibit, during the typical year. But I've been trying to think of a way to sort of have the viewer have that same feeling as a one-on-one, one person, one tree kind of environment. So with Graceful Perseverance, I was able to have the opportunity to try to have all the trees sort of have a cohesive idea and mood. So this way, instead of the trees sort of canceling out each other with all their different energies and different aura and different environments, by creating an overall mood in the whole museum, I'm able to add a good 30, 40, 50 bonsais and hopefully have a unity to the design. And hopefully it'll help the viewers use their imagination and have a real interactive participation with the exhibit.
I see we're almost out of time, Julian, and we're going to have to let you out, but I want to ask you just one question. You mentioned just quickly about this different styles of bonsai.
Sure.
Over the course of the history of bonsai, have there been like specific sort of schools of the way there are in painting or in Japanese artwork?
Yes. Yeah, of course. Bonsai is a reflection of the culture, whether it's Japanese or American or Italian or anything. So it's always going to change and progress depending on just the culture that it's that the artist is living in at the time. So and plus with anything that's over 1,000 years old, there's a new there's tools that are being invented and all these things that kind of force sort of a change in style, of course, but yeah, it's there's definitely always sort of a cultural change with the bonsai, whether it's every 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 100 years ago, you can always sort of see the periods. So yeah, it's just like painting or anything like that. You definitely do see the change of style and shapes and forms and the taste of the culture at the time.
And so in your exhibition, Graceful Perseverance, in addition to creating sort of an overall harmonious unity,
sure.
are you able to exhibit different styles from different
yeah.
eras in the museum's collection? Because you guys have had some wonderful yeah. curators there in
yeah,
the past.
Yeah.
So.
Well, bonsais, they do hold on to the history of their previous caretakers, and usually it's more of the heart and soul of past caretakers. So I could tell the different styles. It's going to be very subtle.
Sure.
But I could, we have trees that are, like I said, hundreds of years old. And, just by the shape of the branches and the movement of the way the tree is shaped, I can tell, a particular year, the person that was taking care of this was very busy this particular year,
uh-huh.
or you know, he really was on top of things that particular year and stuff like that. So it really is amazing. But I don't think the normal visitor might be able to, you know, break it down to such minute detail like that. But sure. You know, the history is there. You know.
Fascinating. Julian, it looks like we have to let you go, so I want to thank you very much for coming in today and sharing some of your information, some of your knowledge about bonsai. And I hope people get a sense of, you know, it's not just a cute little plant in a pot. It's a really profound and spiritual way of accessing nature, particularly for us urban dwellers who don't get to spend a lot of time out in the wild.
Thank you. It's definitely a lifestyle. And the bonsais themselves are great teachers, you know, about life and the environment and in ourselves. You know, bonsais are the mirror image of the people that are viewing them and the people that are creating them. And they really are special little beings.
Yes, I love that they're beings because I feel very strongly attached to trees myself.
Yeah.
I would have an arboretum if I could. Anyway, Julian, let's take a quick break, Jack, and let Julian get out of the studio, and then we'll come right back with Phil Gilmore and Anita Jacobs from the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens.
Sitting alone in the dark, wasting my time in the park, because I've got nowhere to go. Job till the market fell out. Tried hard to borrow, but there was no help. Now I've got nowhere to go. I need a job for these two hands. I'm a working man, nowhere to go. One last look at the land, auctioneer with his gavel in hand, and he said to go. Worked this piece all my life, broke my heart then took my wife. Now I've got nothing to show. I need a job for these two hands. I'm a working man with nowhere to go. Wandered aimless in the city with my dirty work boots and old straw hat in hand, singing a song by Woody Guthrie. This land is your land, it ain't my land. I'm a working man with nowhere to go.
We're back on the main course. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn at 261 Moore Street. And our program today is sponsored by Sam Edwards, or rather S. Wallace Edwards and Son, Cure Master Supreme down in Surrey, Virginia. And our guests, our remaining guests, are Anita Jacobs, who is the Director of Programming at the, am I saying that right, Anita?
Director of Public Programs at Brooklyn Botanic Garden.
Thank you. And Phil Gilmore, who corrected me, he is the proprietor and co-genius behind.
I'm the face. I'm the talent.
He's the
I'm just the pretty
face. He's
the
English speaking. Phil, you just cracked me up. He is the he's the face of the Momo Sushi Shack here in Brooklyn. Where is that, Phil? It's right around the corner.
Yeah, it's right next door to Roberta's. It's 43 Bogart. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that come in for the first time say, you know, I thought you were closed because we have this really Japanese ghetto wooden facade. Yes, that's what we're going for. So
yeah, but that's cool. I've never been to Japan, so yeah. That subtlety would have been lost on me. But I know it's a rather minimalist decor.
Well, the concept is during the winter we want to kind of have it closed off like a kind of almost like a tavern. So you walk by and you don't see it, and when you come inside, you're just transported to not in the middle of industrial Bushwick.
Right.
And then during the summer, though, we have a giant garage door that opens up, so it's completely open air. So
how wonderful.
We're trying to stick to our guns and not put a spotlight out front or one of those balloon guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
but I do reserve the right to change my mind at a later date.
Absolutely. And I think you should, you know, go with where the spirit moves you. I mean, having listened to Julian just now talking about the spirituality of bonsai, the art form of bonsai, I'm so moved.
Beautiful, beautiful, perfect human being he is.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah, he inspires me.
Him and the Dalai Lama. I mean, anyway, so we were the reason we were having this program is because you are both involved in a fantastic exhibition that's opening up. As I said, I think it opened actually earlier this week, February 2nd, and then your grand opening is February 11th. That's this coming Friday, and so let's talk a little bit about the event. And Phil, let's talk about the role of the Momo Sushi Shack in creating this event.
Well, Anita approached me about...
You need to be a little closer to your mic, sweetie.
Anita approached me about a month and a half ago to do the event. I guess her and her family ate at the restaurant, and they, I guess, liked it.
And that would be true.
And, it's kind of, I would say, it's definitely her brainchild. And I'm just honored that, you know, she's invited me to do it, and I'm very, very excited about it.
So these are small plates you're creating, right?
Yes. It's going to be like a, I think we're up
it's
to
a
about
sake a, tasting.
It's a sake and tasting, and we're kind of almost doing like a bento box on a plate.
Beauty.
So there's going to be a pretty nice sized plate, and then there's going to be, I think, 11 little...
We're up to 13.
Is it 13?
Yeah.
Wow. It's going to be...
13 yeah. Beautiful little objects with which to... Are you? Is it like a flight of cheese when you taste cheese, you know, where you start from one end and you mm-hmm. work your way around depending on the strength or the combination of flavors?
Yeah, exactly. And each sake that we're going to present is going to have a few different little tapas to try with each sake.
Fantastic.
So
you
little,
get a very...
It's almost a roller coaster.
Yeah. And Anita, how did this come about? What happened? Like, what inspired this whole thing, aside from the fact that the Botanical Gardens has the amazing bonsai collection?
Well, I was trying to think of something wonderful in February to do that would be a way for people to come out and enjoy the Graceful Perseverance show, which I do think is extraordinary. But I do want to sort of bring back this idea of the passion. I mean, you heard in Julian how he lives his life very much focused on the bonsai, and it is a true and authentic passion that he has.
Yeah.
And that's what I experienced when I went to Momo and met Philip, and the passion that he has about the environment that he's created, which is where you can really feel it's like a private party and everyone gets to know each other, but the passion that he has to translate food to people is unbelievable. And I actually went with my 9-year-old daughter, my husband, and my mother, and he was able to translate, as a funny way, but really translate the food experience by saying, this tomato has been preserving, and you can talk much more eloquently about this, but you know, just kind of pointing out very special things. The care that went into the food and the thought that went into the food reminded me so much of Julian. And I just instantly felt that there was a very powerful connection there. And, you know, the other thing is that Philip is ridiculous and silly and fun, and we want to have a fun, fun night. So we want to have some philosophy and we're having some beautiful dance and some rather more formal and serious pieces. But we really want this to be just a blowout fun night where people can hang out. I mean, what's very special about this event is that we're going to be eating under the stars. It's a giant glass Victorian style greenhouse.
Oh, wow.
So we are going to be experiencing this incredible food and listening to Julian and seeing Japanese folk dance. But we're looking out at the snow. We can look up and see the stars in the city. And it's just a really wonderful thing to be able to do in February.
It's going to be totally magical. And I think you're so inspired to do something like this in February, especially after a winter like this, where we've all been so housebound. And it's been so hard to kind of, you know, get through the last couple of weeks of these, you know, grinding snowstorms and gray days. I mean, I literally, today when I went out, I came to Roberta's and Dawn was outside in her shirt sleeves. You know, so we were like, oh, vitamin D bath. You know? And I think the idea of celebrating nature with this particular art form, which is so, as Julian said, it evokes a landscape. It evokes a spiritual connection to nature, which you really stop feeling when you live in the city and you've been, you know, stuck in the gray, dirty snow for 2.5 months. So I think I applaud your extraordinary imagination and you know ability to sort of channel like the angst of the city as we like.
Well, I know there's actually,
is it ever going to be warm again?
Exactly, and I find myself actually there's one of the bonsai that I really love is a forest. You know, some of them are, you imagine them on a cliff and, you know, being windswept. But some of them are these little forests of trees. And I just personally, every time, as he said, everyone's projecting themselves and their experiences. And so whenever I see that, I think of hiking in Maine. You know, and I have a very sort of connection. And, you know, food is like that too, where you taste something and it brings you, transports you immediately to a different place. And
Proust Madeleine.
Right. It's just it's an incredible thing to be able to kind of get out of where you are at the moment and go someplace else.
Phil, so tell us a little bit about what kind of things you're creating for this event that kind of reflect that whole spiritual gestalt of connecting with nature and being with, you know, miniaturized but still very full experiences of food.
Well, even what's more than the miniature aspect of it is the fact that when Anita approached me about this, I was thinking about what we should serve. I think it's, I'm thinking it's a bonsai exhibition, it's the botanical gardens. And then I kept on trying to think of different meat and fish dishes that would complement bonsai and the botanical gardens. And it just wasn't working.
Yeah,
like,
that doesn't work.
Like, it's Kobe beef and that beef ate vegetables? No. So that's why the concept was to, keep in line with the botanical garden and the bonsai exhibit by doing a mostly, it's going to be almost all vegan. I think there's one dish with a little bit of egg in it, but keeping true to like the plant, the respect the plants. So,
I love that.
And also too, it's like, the thing I've been thinking about recently is that everybody thinks about Kobe beef and sushi and, you know, pork and all these things with Japanese cuisine. But the thing is that there's so much amazing vegetarian vegan cuisine. They don't call it that, but there is. It's especially 100 years ago or 200 years ago, you didn't eat meat and fish every day. You foraged for root vegetables and herbs, you know. So, you go to some restaurants and they have 10 or 12 vegan or vegetarian dishes and it's just the same dish recreated. But with Japanese cuisine, there's infinite, you know, vegetarian options.
Fantastic. I mean, it's true. I don't think people think of Japanese cuisine as being essentially, I mean, there's tofu, there's noodles, and then there's rice and fish. I mean, that's, you know, and then the occasional piece of pork or beef.
I was thinking about I was thinking about yesterday was the whole slow food movement.
Sure.
And it's kind of, I almost feel that it's specifically American in the sense that like every other culture in every other country kind of does slow food anyways.
It's so true.
Especially Japanese, but you know, they're so humble that they don't say we do slow food. You should just, unless you're eating it like a, you know, cheap, you know, cheap sushi restaurant.
Yeah.
If it's a true Japanese, you know, restaurant, you should assume that it's going to be slow food. The way that they take the care that they take, they don't do the quick route. They do the slow, you know.
Well, you bring to mind something which I've never experienced personally, but I have read about, and that is the whole school of kaiseki cooking,
mm-hmm.
which I think totally exemplifies that concept of slow, and it's so deliberate, and there is such an aesthetic quality.
Seasonal.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also the aesthetic of every dish has to be very specific, I believe. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
That it has to look a certain way, and that this look has passed down through many, many generations of cooks.
And also the look is also seasonal. The ingredients are seasonal, and it's like, you know, it's cold outside, so this is what you should eat, and this is what it should look like because it's cold outside.
Yeah. I mean, I find that amazing because of course we never think about that here and even in European countries it's not such a, you know, it's not, you eat cold, you know, you eat a braised dish because, you know, you're using something that's been preserved or it's a way to keep something going for a long time or I don't know, whatever the reason is, it cooks well in a hearth, I don't know, but I remember going to an exhibition at the French Culinary Institute a few years ago that was the culmination of a weekend of Japanese chefs who had been flown in by the FCI. It was a kind of an international like checkout, and it's amazing how few Americans were at this extraordinary event. And it I was only there for one part of it, and that was a 3-hour seminar on cooking rice.
Wow.
And it was like they had spent $5,000 to create a glass cooker so that we could actually watch as the rice absorbed the water. And they, you know, went through all the different kinds of rice and how many baths you had to have and what you were looking for in each specific type of preparation. And I mean, it was just, who knew? I mean, for an American, it was like rice is, you know, Uncle Ben's. I mean,
it's funny you mentioned the French Culinary Institute, too, because I think there's this mutual admiration between France and Japan. Because I think you know, I actually, when Julian was talking about simplicity, I saw, you know, Joël Robuchon.
Of course.
With a lot of his dishes, he takes, you know, like a protein, and then his kind of rule, which I think he sometimes breaks, but he only 5 ingredients. Uh-huh. If you have this amazing piece of fish or this amazing piece of meat, and that includes salt and pepper and oil.
Right.
You know, that you should not, there. If you have the most beautiful piece of fish or the most beautiful piece of meat, you do not need to put 15 things on it.
That's right.
The sauce that you put on it does not have to have 15 things because you're almost like insulting it. You know?
It's a purity issue.
It's a purity issue.
Absolutely.
You know, why would you want to, you know, mess with it if it's already
perfect?
That's
right.
You know?
I mean, if you were able to source something like that, you want to let those flavors be the dominant thing.
Yeah.
No, not the fact that you know how to manipulate eggs and cream and butter and, you know, XYZ herbs or spices. It's true.
A side note, did I pronounce Joël Robuchon right?
You did very well. Presque parfait. but there is a lot of, there's just a lot of overlap between the way Japanese food looks and their whole sort of approach to aesthetics in their everyday lives. I mean, when you think about Japanese culture, I always think about, okay, maybe not necessarily miniaturized like bonsai or even like the sushi little rolls or whatever, but just, every single aspect is thought through with a sense of like, how is this going to make me feel? What emotion am I going to, you know, gather from being in a tatami room? Or, I mean, just to, I don't know anything about Japanese culture, but those sort of like totems of the way Japanese people live with the shoji screens and the tatami mats and everything is really simple and crisp and pure and the opulence of the kimonos or the Japanese prints with the detail. I mean, I just find the aesthetic sense of Japan permeates every aspect of the culture in a way that I think is kind of unique almost. I mean, maybe the Chinese as well, but, Phil, how did you like get into the whole, cause you're just a Yank.
Yeah. I'm just a Yank. I'm just a
South. Did you spend a lot of time in Japan?
I haven't.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. How it came about was I worked at, Bozu, which is Makoto Suzuki, who's my business partner, my chef at Momo. Mm-hmm. I worked at, Bozu for about 3 years, and before I worked at Bozu, I loved Japanese food, but you know, I knew about as much as anybody else about it,
right?
And it just kind of hooked me in, you know, with the care that they take for the food and the just the wide variety, and then especially sake. I really love sake.
Yeah.
It just kind of you know.
I should also just say that Makoto Suzuki, the chef that's working on this and that is the chef for Momo, he's also kind of an incredible genius. And when we started actually thinking, okay, well, you know, we wanted to do vegan or vegetarian food, and, you know, his whole face, he had just gotten off a plane from Japan. I mean, he was totally jet lagged, but his entire face lit up and he just had that passion and excitement, and it's just been a really fun process for us to kind of think about all these different possibilities that he had. And Philip, you should really, I brought the menu out because I think you should share some of the incredible things.
I'm so glad you brought that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Maybe, do you want to look at it and you can ask me questions about
it?
Or,
yeah, I do. Thanks.
And you should also mention, you mentioned sake a little bit, but, you know, a big part of this evening is a pairing. I mean, you're going to be narrating the food in conjunction with very carefully thought out and paired sakes that are, you know, very special.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the sake piece?
Well, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been working with Hiromi to match perfectly the sake with each dish. And, you know, with sake, there's... It doesn't have as wide a variety as, say, wine, but it definitely, it's more minute differences. It's not like, you know, if you have a giant red wine or a sweet red wine, there's these, you know, contrasts. Sake is kind of, you know, this...
Within a spectrum.
Within a spectrum, but within that spectrum, it's almost like the bonsai, these minute details that unless you know a lot about sake, you wouldn't notice. But those minute details I love so much, just a little dryness or a little, you know,
and
little
so
bit more fragrant.
And so when you decided, for instance, here's one of the incredible sounding dishes that people are going to be sampling on February 11th at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, shaved lotus root.
Uh-huh.
Simmered in sesame oil and vegan dashi. Now, isn't dashi, that's like dried bonito flakes this is a vegetarian?
Well, dashi is the broth. It's the bonito flakes.
The broth.
Yeah, it's the bonito flakes and the kelp.
Ah.
And water. It's the base of almost all Japanese cooking, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And that, why does that pair particularly well with the sujin junmai sake?
So with the kimpira... it's lotus root, which has this really high amount of starch because it grows in water. Uh-huh. And we also put the sesame oil in there. So it has this kind of almost like it cooks for about, you know, a couple hours. The starch comes out and emulsifies with the kombu kelp broth and the sesame oil. So it almost makes it's almost like this like creaminess with the lotus root. But the lotus root is still crunchy, but it has this like a little bit sweet and creamy aspect to it. And sujin is one of the driest sakis in the world, if not the driest. It's almost slightly astringent. It has it does not have a ton of fragrance to it. So the dryness kind of complements the creaminess and sweetness of the lotus root, and also the crunch as well.
Nice. And then the other thing that I notice here, like just going quickly through this menu, is you use a lot of vinegars and a lot of pickled vegetables here. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't think people really necessarily think of Japanese cuisine as having that sort of acid and
so much.
But so much. Yeah,
so much.
Why don't we see more of that? And I mean, or maybe it's just because I never go to Japanese restaurants, but...
Well, I think, Japanese American restaurants are different than Japanese restaurants.
Yeah.
If you go to really hardcore Japanese restaurants, you're always going to see lots of preserved and pickled things. Yeah.
And that fits right in with the whole Brooklyn DIY culture, doesn't it?
Yeah, just right?
Like pickles?
Exactly.
You're right.
Talk about trendy, man.
I'm trying to play that up as much as I can. We made these pickles ourselves in-house.
Yeah, cool. I love that. Yeah, we've got to get Elizabeth Meltz in for a little HACCP.
Yeah, right?
Although pickled vegetables, I think, you know, that's okay. I see that we have just about 7 more minutes. So, Anita, let's talk a little bit about how people can get to this event and buy tickets and what to expect and what's going to happen. Because we haven't even touched on the fact that there are Japanese folk dancers coming, that Phil will be giving a talk about the cuisine, that presumably somebody will be talking about the sake, Julian will be talking about the bonsai. So let's expand a little bit on that. And then afterwards, there's some like kind of crazy, crazy party going on, right?
Yes.
Spinning some 70s, what did you call it?
60s group sounds.
60s group sounds. I don't even know what that means.
It's like a Beatle-esque music that was in Japan in the 60s, and you'll see those Beatle outfits and Beatle haircuts, and it's all...
Are people
Japanese
going to be wearing Beatle outfits?
Several people I know are, but
really?
We don't know.
Phil?
I am the walrus who cuckoo.
That sounds really... I mean, this is going to be an incredible event. So it starts on... it's Friday, February 11th. It starts at what time?
It starts at 6:30. And Julian, actually, between 6:30 and 7:30, he will be taking people on tours of Graceful Perseverance. So that's sort of your... You know, as people are arriving, if they feel like doing a tour at that point, that's great. And he'll also do some later in the evening as well.
I think it's worth coming just to be in Julian's presence for a minute.
Absolutely.
He's such
Wear your white robes. Or your saffron robes. Will he be wearing a saffron robe? He really should be.
I don't know. To be seen.
He does have a very sort of monastic
The haircut
quality,
I think, yeah.
But just like his whole demeanor, this very like low key, but you know, deep. Talk about deep roots.
It's always he's always like that. It's really what you saw is the way he is all the time.
Oh my God, bless him!
And he comes in 7 days a week. You know,
yeah,
just to
take care of his trees,
his babies. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I loved that he spoke about them as sort of individual living beings that he has this connection with. That piece that you sent me, Anita, was so beautiful. I loved it.
Great.
I read it about four times. I thought it was so great. Go ahead, Phil. I'm sorry I cut you off.
Just Julian, like any person that has the passion and love for what they do as much as Julian, it warms my heart. I just, that's why I wish
share that. Yes.
Well, maybe, but I wish that on every person in the world.
Me too, because
there's so many people that are unhappy doing
yes.
what they're doing, and the fact that he's doing exactly what he loves and is so passionate about it, it's beautiful.
It's much like Jack, who is doing exactly what I know he loves, engineering and tagging and producing for us today. So to get to the tickets, we go to the Bronx Botanical Garden website. And
I wouldn't go to Bronx Botanical Garden website.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Brooklyn Botanical Garden, bbg.org. But also, you can get a little preview if you go to Momo Sushi Shack and have a meal there and pick up some tickets there, too.
That's right. And otherwise, they can get tickets there, or they can get tickets through brown paper tickets, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, we keep talking about this issue of passion and sincerity. And another thing we haven't really talked about is that I'm bringing in an amazing friend and an incredible group. Momo Suzuki grew up in Japan and started studying Japanese folk dances in rural areas and traveled around as a very young woman, learning what was at that time a dying art form.
Uh-huh.
And she has made it her life's mission and passion to bring these dances to New York City, and they have died out in Japan.
Oh, no.
There's just, it's an incredible thing that she's done and kind of a gift. And she's bringing a number of these dances to us throughout the evening. And it's been a lot of fun working with her on this too, because she's thought about, she's doing a rice cake dance and sort of, you know, connecting with the theme of this, and a lot of New Year's related things, because a menu that we're doing with the vegetables has a real New Year flavor to it. So her dances are connecting to that as well. So what's really just an incredible thing to do these events is that it's a connection of different people that have strong passions, and getting them all into one room is kind of my dream.
Absolutely.
And I feel like a lot of our guests that are coming have their own incredible passions, and it just feels to me like it's going to be a very special evening.
It sounds like it. I mean, I can't wait to go, and I urge everyone who listens to this program to rush right on over to the Brooklyn Botanical Garden website and get a preview, because you can see some of the bonsai on the website, no?
Yes,
yeah,
you can.
So you can kind of see what we're talking about and learn more about this event and more about Phil Gilmore and Momo Sushi Shack.
And if you come to Momo, I have about 400 pictures on my iPhone of the bonsais, because they were so beautiful I couldn't stop taking the picture.
You can project them on the wall.
Yeah. And also too, I just wanted to mention too that people that come to the event also get a tour of the all of the bonsai, correct?
Yes, and we're doing a combination. Julian's going to do personal tours, but we will also, he is loaning me for the night 8 very, very special pieces from the collection that will be in the room with us, sort of overseeing our dinner.
So we can all connect deeply with those spiritual, those tree spirits, which I know they have them. I remember as a child, I always believed in hamadryads and dryads, and I still do. And I think the idea of connecting with these exquisite little pieces and learning more about their history and
little
having
beings.
The little beings and having this opportunity to really dig into Japanese culture in a way that I think sounds very unusual and very unique for most Americans. I doubt that there will be many of us who have, without having traveled to Japan, will have anything like as authentic an experience as we're going to have on February 11th and throughout the rest of the exhibit, which goes until May 2nd, right? So I want to thank you both very much for coming, Phil Gilmore and Anita Jacobs, and our previous guest, Julian Velasquez. This has been the main course. We're going to have a short, this is a short, shortened version because Patrick is not with me today.
Hi, Patrick. I love you.
but I want to urge people to listen again next week when Jeffrey Steingarten will be joining us from Vogue magazine, and Brad Farmery, the winner of Cochon 555 and the owner and chef of, one of the owners and chef of Double Crown and Public. So please come back next week, and thanks again to our sponsor, S. Wallace Edwards & Son. So long.